Okay.
That can be down there.
Well, good morning. Good morning to Zoom. Killian used to give Dharma talks almost every autumn on the theme of what he did during summer vacation. And the talks would typically elicit some Dharma lessons from those vacations. So my talk follows on that tradition, though my summer vacation was actually last fall. And the Dharma of my talk is around the Dharma of the three characteristics of existence, also sometimes called the three marks of existence or the three Dharma seals. By the way, can everybody hear me okay? I can't see Zoom people happy. Okay, yeah. Good. So the three characteristics of existence are usually taught as dukkha, which is Pali for suffering or unsatisfactoriness, yuckness; anicca, impermanence; and anatta, not self. And my way into these today is through an examination of identity. So for a little bit of context, I was on sabbatical. I grabbed sabbatical from my Dharma Rain teaching role and responsibilities during calendar year 2021. This followed from my seeing my 75th birthday, which was at the end of 2020, as a milestone event, inviting retreat from my regular existence to allow space to examine what I'm doing, what's important to me, and what I want to do going forward. Some of the questions that came up for me around this were, am I living by my deepest aspirations? Where am I stuck? And I saw this as a kind of rebooting. So this last September, I took a further step into sabbatical by leaving home. And by home, I mean Portland, Dharma Rain, and my physical house. I left for a 1.5-month road trip down to the southwest U.S., Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah for the most part. And during most of that time, I was living outdoors in a tent in over a dozen both primitive and developed campgrounds. And I found that living outdoors in natural areas for an extended period itself provided a powerful container for my exploration in the form of the removal of the safety of a roof and walls. I felt more vulnerable in a good opening way. More vulnerable, more exposed, more open. And I can't say that I anticipated that or planned that before the trip, but it played out that way. It fit well, in retrospect, it fit well with the Buddhist tradition of home leaving, which goes back to the Buddha's leaving his life as a prince, as a husband, as a father, to plunge into the mysteries of suffering and impermanence. And the tradition goes further back than that. I think most religious traditions have some practice of home leaving. And though it didn't occur to me as I was planning the trip, as the trip progressed, I became very aware of the power of that home leaving. My daily life during those 1.5 months felt a lot like sesshin, at least like our wilderness, mountains, and water sesshins. Mindful doing of what needed to be done without a lot of extra. Paying attention to and allowing whatever was happening, which in this case included extremes of weather, temperatures from the low teens to 100. physical discomfort at times, aversion, you know, nothing new about that. And lots of hiking, cooking, cleaning, emotions of fear, joy, and sometimes just blahness. And lots of zazen. Some prominent themes that emerged for me from this were exploration around identity, stuckness, impermanence, fear, and liberation. A real brief look at that term liberation. We hear that word often, but what is it? Liberation from what? To what? The Pali Canon refers to liberation of the mind, and in other places, liberation from conditioned existence. So this refers back to our teachings around habit energy, dependent origination. One thing I wanted to emphasize this morning is feeling that from what? Feeling your yuckness, feeling your suffering, feeling your dukkha. If you can feel it in body, heart, and mind, you might find that it's a powerful motivator. So know your dukkha. Quite some years ago, I was having a conversation with Chosen Bays, the co-abbot at Great Vow Monastery. And I asked her what their koan practice was all about. So she had lots to say about that. But then eventually she ran out of steam and said, but you know, fundamentally they all come down to the fundamental koan of who am I? Dogen's famous statement in the Genjo Koan fascicle is another take on this. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. This quote points to anicca, anatta, impermanence, not self. It also points to what some teachers consider the first characteristic. Some teachers X out dukkha and put in nirvana as the first characteristic. Myself, I usually just allow, just think of it as four characteristics. But anyway, that first characteristic of nirvana. I would suggest that the question, who am I, is most useful if it remains a question, an attitude of question. Beware of any answers that you might conjure up. Conceptual thought is actually counterproductive with this question. And the questioning you may find will not even be verbal. Quoting a contemporary Buddhist teacher, Steve Hagen, out of Minneapolis, in his book, Buddhism is Not What You Think, he says, Nagarjuna makes it abundantly clear that impermanence, the relative, is total, complete, thoroughgoing, absolute. It's not that the universe is made up of innumerable objects in flux. There's only flux. Nothing is or can be riding along in the flux like a cork in a stream. Nothing actually arises or passes away. There's only stream. So I've introduced with these quotes and these explanations a bit of a mix of impermanence and not self. I don't think this is just sloppy dharma. The Pali Canon mixes these also. Impermanence and not self are not different things. They're just different ways into the fundamental truth of the three characteristics. Impermanence obviously implies not self. And the opposite is also true. And the first characteristic, dukkha, describes the result of resisting the other two and provides the motivation for opening to the other two. So I picked for the title of my talk, Am I Willing to Change? This is a mantra I often turn to when I realize I'm up against a wall of my own making. which, by the way, I think most walls are. I also use this mantra at those times that my deepest aspiration is calling to me particularly loudly. When I feel there's a choice ahead of me, am I willing to make that choice? Another way to ask this question might be, are you willing to let go of who you thought you were? Now, change happens whether we're willing for it to happen or not. Impermanence is. But our suffering and our joy depend on whether we open-heartedly allow that change to happen rather than resent and resist it. We just tend to spend much or most of our time in samsara. Samsara, if you're not familiar with that term, is the complex cycle of death and rebirth, relative existence. It's portrayed in the Wheel of Life. And in samsara, we're constantly creating fragments of identity, which harden into fortresses of self. Often many of these identity fragments define ourselves in a negative, limiting way. For example, I'm no good at that. I don't fit in. I'm terrible at relationships. I disappoint everyone who loves me. If I try to help, I'll just end up screwing everything up for everyone. I'm too old to do whatever. And I'm sure you can think of more examples that come up for you. Now, these tend to limit what we're willing to try. They close our body, heart, and mind to the possibility of being more. And we can physically feel the restricting effects of such negative identities. We might feel them as a physical contraction, a tightness in our neck, our face, chest, abdomen. Negative identities typically come with fear. And I'm not sure which causes which, but they sure nurture each other. What about so-called positive or wholesome identities? Examples might be, I'm someone who never breaks the precepts. Ha. I don't lie. If I try, I can do it. I'm a kind person. I'm a good wife or husband or father, worker, practitioner. Aren't these positive identities healthy? Well, first, I would say that there's an important difference between identity and aspiration. Identifying with these characteristics is a hardening. Aspiration is an opening. Personal aspiration and values can pull us towards wholesome behavior, whereas identity is fundamentally delusion. Clinging to an identity results in dukkha. Impermanence teaches us that we're never always one thing, one personality, a me who's always brave or wise or truthful or whatever. I think positive identities actually share a lot of characteristics with negative identities. They limit our options and can harden our hearts and our minds. When there's discordance between the identity and what we're pulled to do, we might act out of self-imposed rule and not by the aliveness that inhabits wise action. Arrogance is often a byproduct of these positive identities. And arrogance is also a contraction, a concretization, a hardening. And I think fairly obviously it causes harm to self and others. Positive identities even result in their own types of fear, perhaps a fear that the facade will crack and people, or worse, yourself, will see through to the real you. Quote, real you, not the real you. And a fear of failure. Are self and the identities behind self sometimes useful? Well, relationships require some degree of consistency. They go better if agreements and promises are kept. And navigating the relative world also benefits from some degree of consistency. The world has rules, rules of nature, rules of governments, rules of communities, rules of sanghas. And ignoring or breaking these rules have consequences. Karma functions. But our practice is about honoring these relationships and rules without hardening into identities of self. I'm not going to go into this in this talk, but we do have a number of teachings around how to integrate the relative and the absolute, the five ranks and other Buddhist dharma guides us towards that, guides us towards integration of living in impermanence and not self, at the same time as functioning as selves in the relative world. Now, turning to my own experience with these koans, who am I, and am I willing to change? I recognize and acknowledge that I've layered on many fragments of identity over my lifetime. And I want to share with you today one specific example of a lesson that I learned about identity during my road trip. Most people, I think, have some favored style or styles of learning, which might be reading or discussing, seeing, hearing. For me, it's often through physical action. I learn from my body. So on this road trip, my general plan was it was going to be an outdoor trip, and I was going to visit a number of national parks, national monuments, wilderness areas, and do a whole bunch of hiking. And in the back of my mind was this belief identity that I think I've held most of my life, that I'm a person who's uncomfortable with being near steep fall-offs, fear of heights, fear of exposures. So, again, planning the trip, I kind of assumed that I just wouldn't go anywhere that would trigger that fear. So, if I was reading a trail guide, if it mentioned steep fall-off or not for somebody who's afraid of heights, I would just mentally cross it off in my mind. If there wasn't any trail description to be found, I might ask a ranger if one was available. And I would explain kind of very bashfully that, I'm kind of uncomfortable with steep fall-offs. How am I going to do on this hike? And usually they would say, well, I don't know, but give it a try and turn back if it's too much for you, which I thought was great advice, and I did it. I tried that over and over again. And some real classics of steep fall-offs, Grand Canyon, Bryce Canyon, Rio Grande Gorge, Chimney Rock, Chaco Canyon, Bandelier National Monument. And each time I found with some surprise that I was actually pretty comfortable. Actually, a lot of surprise. I didn't feel fear. And I gradually learned that I wasn't my imagined identity, that I'm someone who's terrified of big exposures. Now, this wasn't about courage, but more about a willingness to try something and curious about that, what that would be like. So willingness and curiosity rather than constriction and fear. And that's probably the most important thing I want you to get from my talk today, is to invite and nurture willingness and curiosity rather than default into constriction and fear. So what is this fear of heights? Well, like many fears, maybe most, it's existential. It's a fear of extinction, of ceasing to exist. Impermanence, fear of loss of a self. For me, it was a very old fear, and I think many fears are very old. I could trace it back to at least when I was 9 years old. Our family did a long cross-country trip. We lived on the East Coast at that time, and we visited a number of these national parks. And when we got to Bryce Canyon, we started out on a trail, and we got a few feet into it when my dad stopped us and said, no, this isn't safe. We won't go down here. I have to say, there was a little bit of shosh. This will show you, Dad, in my visit to Bryce Canyon and just skipping over all the trails there. The fear, well, true of all fears, and I think literally true of the fear of heights, it was, for me, it's about living in my head, feeling self as located in my head, identifying around the stories that I've told myself. And along those lines, you know, some years ago, I was backpacking up in Ghost Rock Wilderness, Goat Rocks Wilderness, I'm sorry. was walking along this area with a steep fall off and started feeling a little bit uncomfortable. And found that if I actually directed my consciousness down to my feet, the fear went away. Living in my head, living in my feet. Trekking poles helped also. So this gets to another way of asking the question, who am I? You can actually ask that question with any of the five W's, but where am I? Where is my consciousness? And loosening up on where you feel your consciousness can have benefits. There are actually practices for this. So this trip, living outdoors for 1.5 months, letting new experiences touch me deeply, it nurtured in me a very expansive sense of possibility. That many of my previously held limitations, like fear of heights, being old, being unsafe in the world, not fitting in, that these were untrue and unnecessary, at least not currently needed or warranted. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, in his book, Not Always So, said, I feel sorry that I cannot help you very much, but the way to study true Zen is not verbal. Just open yourself and give up everything. Whatever happens, whether you think it is good or bad, study closely and see what you find out. This is the fundamental attitude. This is what it means to surrender. Even though you have nothing to surrender. Without losing yourself by sticking to a particular rule or understanding, keep finding yourself moment after moment. This is the only thing for you to do. There's an old koan about jumping off the 100-foot pole. It shows up in a couple of the different koan collections. And I'm going to read to you from the Book of Serenity, Case 79. Changsha said, even though one who is sitting on top of a 100-foot pole has entered realization, it is not yet real. You must step forward from the top of the 100-foot pole. The world of 10 directions is your entire body. And there's commentary on that and so on, and I'm not going to go into that very far, but the metaphor of the pole evokes that fundamental attitude that Suzuki Roshi pointed to. Just open yourself and give up everything. It's a very physical reminder of our spiritual instinct, the mind that seeks the way, the heart that longs to open. And it also points to that koan of fear. The third bodhisattva vow, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them, also evokes that jump off the 100-foot pole. And I also often just recall the question, am I willing to change? And the very act of asking myself this is usually enough to notice and let go of my resistance to change. Back around 1980, before Dharma Rain existed, a small group of us who were practicing at that time with Oregon Zen Priory went for a very short retreat at Shasta Abbey in California, which was basically our parent temple. It's where Kyogen and Gyokoko trained. And during that retreat, I don't remember how long it was. I think it was 3, 4, or 5 days, something like that. During that time, we got to meet with Roshi Kennett. And somebody asked her the question, when I go deep in my zazen, I often come to a place where I'm overwhelmed by fear. What can I do about that? And Roshi Kennett, as she often would, answered with this huge smile and a booming voice, "Welcome it, it's your friend." So it's taken me years working with that, but I'm starting to understand that, I think. Fear can be a bedrock against which I can push off into the unknown. It reminds me that I bound myself with the fear and that this tends to awaken me to my deep aspiration to open in body, heart, and mind. Fear can point to our path, and fear can bring us back to now. So I used to include in my metaverse, "May we be free of fear," but this didn't feel quite right. So lately it's morphed into, "May we all find our paths through fear." So how do we do this work? How do we get unstuck from our self-identities, born of dependent origination, born of beginningless greed, hate, and delusion? How do we deal with concrete walls of habit energy? Well, first and foremost, nurture the habit of noticing what's happening internally. And we have a number of practices that can help us with this. Actually, our whole practice is oriented towards this. One practice that I often come back to, and you've heard about, I think, a lot here, has the acronym RAIN, where the R stands for recognize what's going on. The A stands for accept or allow. You can recognize that something is going on, that you feel tight, whatever, but not accept it. You want to reject it. So the A is accept it. The I is investigate. Thoroughly feel it. How is it working on you? And the N is our old friend, non-identification, not self. This is not who you are. If you want to look further into that, Tara Brach has a lot of writings on that. Jack Kornfield also talks about it. So per Roshi Kennett, when fear arises, welcome it as a friend. Per Suzuki Roshi, whatever happens, whether you think it's good or bad, study it closely and see what you find out. Add nothing extra. You may find that this naturally transforms into curiosity, open and often rather humorous. No self-judgment, just open wonder at what is this? Who am I now? And as I suggested earlier, learn to feel your stuckness, your dukkha. But don't tell yourself stories about it, okay? The stories are a problem. This can be a huge motivator for practice and liberation. Physically feel it. Physically feel your dukkha. It may manifest as heaviness, tightness, as I mentioned, or perhaps hints of depression, like apathy or very low energy. Pay attention to your body. Listen to your body, to your heart. And notice your thoughts as delusions when they are. Help with that is the second bodhisattva vow. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to see them, or I vow to end them. And I bring up that vow because stuckness gets a staying power from the stories that we construct and how many times we tell ourselves those same or similar stories. For example, my fear of heights or common insecurities around perceived inadequacy. Even so-called positive stories can constrict. I'm special, I'm better than you. And I encourage you not to make this practice about dualities, like should and shouldn't, good and bad, right and wrong, good Buddhist, bad Buddhist, and so forth. Just open to a bare awareness of how it feels. Allow joy in these small steps of liberation. You might find that these epiphanies of, oh, that's not who I am, or, oh, I'm not who I thought I was, or, I no longer need to contract over this imagined quality of self, that these epiphanies awaken a sense of spaciousness and new freedom. You may find yourself in a new space of awareness, transient, but real in the moment and valuable in developing faith in our practice. I encourage you to allow surprises, welcome them, take joy in them. This is a natural byproduct of paying attention to and allowing what is. Allow time for change. Learning to flow with impermanence isn't instantaneous. Habit energy is stubborn. So that's my Dharma talk. Thank you. And we'll go to questions and comments. But before we do that, one thing I want to introduce today is that you say your name before you present your question or comment. I know the Zoom participants can't see who in the hall is asking questions. And well, I sure can't see the screen from here. So I think a number of us can't see who on Zoom is asking questions. So I'm hoping that saying our names will make our hybrid experience a little more personal and strengthen our sense of Sangha in these Sangha challenging times. So open to questions and comments now.
You're on Zoom and have a question, go ahead and type your name or your question or comment in the chat box, and we will either unmute you or read that aloud. If you are in the Zendo, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll bring the mic to you.
My name is Christina. Thank you for your talk. Your trip sounds really cool. And, well, a trip seems like a natural time to loosen identity a little bit. You know, you're not in your usual patterns. And I think you said a little about this, but maybe you could say more about how to loosen that when you're in your normal life. And all this, you know, it's not just your own stories about yourself. It's all the other stories that people around you have, or like, just the context of your day-to-day, if you would.
Okay, good. Going from the trip back to normal life was a natural answer to that question, but it doesn't answer your question about what if you can't take that trip. I think all of these things that I pointed to are available to us in our daily lives. Our fears are certainly available to us. Our stories are available to us. And the walls that we construct are available to us. I think it's important to pause frequently, if needed, to come back to a sense of what's important to me. And to check in with where you're at. Actually, for some years now, I've gotten into multiple Zazen periods a day, but I make them shorter because I figure if I'm going to shoot for 20 minutes three times a day, and each of those is kind of a rebooting, a recentering, and I found that to be very helpful. You could play with that too, stopping often enough to come back to what you really want to do.
Thank you.
On Zoom, we have a comment from Susanna. She just says, thank you for your talk. Then also from Kate, she's asking, would you expand on deconstructing known walls?
Could you say that once more? Deconstructing what?
Would you expand on deconstructing known walls? Wall as in bricks and mortar, right?
Deconstructing walls.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of different routes towards that. The first and most important, I think, is realizing that there is a wall there. Because I think too often we're just kind of mired in our dukkha rather than realizing that we've created something that is causing this dukkha. And then I would come back to what I was suggesting, that rather than reacting with fear and constriction or self-defining that I am not able, I'm not capable of doing whatever it is, to have some openness around it, some question around it. What is true here? Am I really subject to what I have put myself subject to? That's what occurs to me right now. Does that help with your question?
Tony was relaying the question so the back and forth would be slow.
Oh, okay.
May I ask, can you hear me?
Yes.
I was thinking, I am aware of the walls, old. I mean, they're old. I'm aware of them. I can go around them. it feels as though I need a huge, I don't know, sledgehammer. I'm not afraid of them, but I can't seem to break through. Have you any advice? I'm fairly new to Buddhism, couple years, you know, few years. Uh-huh. So maybe that tells you something too.
Well, so I've been doing this for 50 years, give or take, and I still have my walls. So, and I'm probably still creating some walls. So be gentle on yourself, you know, and don't judge yourself for having these walls. If you can invite curiosity in, you may find that that loosens it up a little bit. I think we often approach our dukkha and our stuckness in kind of a but antagonistic way, and I don't think that helps.
True.
I should also point out that, you know, our Zen practice is one approach to this, and I think it's a good approach. Some walls might benefit from therapy. It's not inconsistent with our practice.
Thank you.
Sure.
Have one in the Zendo.
Take a second. So my name is Daigai, and you know, talking about encountering fear and having in practice and having this sense of something being on the other side of that, that of which you're afraid, And this was for years, this has been pretty interesting to me. And it's even more interesting now as I bump up against that. And then I see that there really is nothing there on the other side of that place of resistance. It seems to be fear of nothing. But it can still be rather intractable, nevertheless. And so I'm curious about it. And realizing now as I'm speaking to you that there's really nothing you're going to say to me that's going to change what that feels like, other than, you know, I'm left with sort of look at it again and be there with it. And I don't suppose there's much more, but I'd be happy to hear anything you have to say.
Well, that was pretty good. I come back to that thing that fear that we might encounter in Zazen. Is that fear of stepping off the 100-foot pole? And it's a fear of extinction. Extinction of what?
I've never been able to answer that. Extinction of what? The what just doesn't seem to be there.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest you just be with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Daicho has a question on Zoom.
Hi. And thank you for the name thing. My name is Daicho, and I've been thinking about that too, because sometimes I don't understand who is talking, and it's frustrating. So thank you for that. And my question is that about the fear. When I think about, you know, some like jumps that happened in my life in the past, oftentimes, well, there's a fear, but also I felt like, in a way, it happened so naturally. And in retrospect, you know, I felt like, wow, what did I do? But, you know, when I was doing it, there's somehow it just happened. And so there's a fear is a factor, but also there's another thing that's a little harder to describe. It's some kind of maybe like some kind of urge that can you talk about something about that? Because, you know, willing to change is kind of broad, but there's always something specific that you know, somehow like pushing you to do something.
I'm not quite clear on your question.
There is something happens in a situation like that. There's a fear of doing something, but at the same time, you recognize that there's some sort of, like, well, I would say urge to do something. And I guess my question is, so sometimes maybe, well, what is this urge? And also, is it good to, you know, follow the urge always, or do I have to, well, think about it or something? I don't know. I mean, in the past, I felt like I wasn't really thinking, and just the urge is strong, I just do it. But yeah, I guess
I'm not sure what urge you're talking about, but drawing back on my example of the hiking that I was doing with around, you know, steep fall-offs, I guess I suppose I felt somewhat of an urge to, probably the real urge was to explore that fear, to see what that was about, to see if it was real. And there may have been some urge around the question of who am I? Who am I in light of this, of what's going on? Does that ring a bell at all?
I'm not sure. I just felt like well, it's always kind of afterthought of doing something and then, it's one thing to, you know, like go against the fear, but at the same time, I guess in some way, like, I felt like sometimes I was just too, what's the word? I can't come up with an English word, but reckless. And I guess that's a thing that, okay, so some fears are healthy.
Okay, that there actually is something to be afraid of. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there are things that you should be afraid of. And so how do you navigate that?
I think a lot of fear is of future, of what might happen. And so one way to navigate that is to try to come back from the future to now. But you know, there are valid reasons to, I don't know that the fear side of it is so important. You know, fear tends to kind of cloud judgment and so on, I think. But the alert that something in the future might damage you, you know, that can be a valid thing. I have found that probably the things in my life that were most imminent as a danger, I didn't feel any fear at the time. You know, that when you're in the situation, you deal with the situation in whatever you do. And I could bring up examples about that, but you know, the truly scary things did not scare me because they were right now.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
So I'm Genko. I have a couple of things. One about walls. Early on in my practice, I was having a lot of trouble hitting walls and becoming more aware of them, and they were like brick. And they changed here and there in terms of my perception of them, but it was a very clear sort of visual mind object. And I mentioned it, or I was talking with Kyogen about it, and he says, well, sometimes it's helpful to lean into it. So as I started like imagining myself physically leaning against this wall, it got softer. It started to feel sort of comfortable. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What's going on with that? And that kind of helped me to begin to see why I had constructed the walls and what I found useful about them. And gradually being able to sort of interact with it in a less, like you say, sort of antagonistic or oppositional way allowed me to explore it in a way that it gradually lost a lot of its power. So sometimes a visual metaphor, if you want to call it that, can be useful for stuff like that. So I wanted to point that out. The other thing is I wanted to thank you for the hint about moving from the head to the feet, putting the emphasis or the awareness into the feet. When I was I had the opposite experience of you. When I was a child, I was all over everything. I was climbing the tallest trees, and I was like leaning over edges of things, and you know, it was fine, and I knew I was fine, you know, I think because I was just in the body at that point. As I got older and started having an imagination and looking to see what my, you know, what I might think about what might happen there, I got more afraid. So, when you said that, I thought, oh yeah, you know, I can totally see how that would work. So, I've definitely done a lot of living in my head and have been in many ways kind of estranged from my body in during my life. At this point, of course, as I age, I notice a significant wobble.
Significant
wobble. It's not all the time. Most of the time my balance is fine and I'm steady as a rock, and then every once in a while, boink, I'm suddenly leaning against a wall or, you know, falling here or there, and it's just really kind of unnerving. So now I have to be more aware of, like, you know, holding on to things or, you know, putting my attention maybe back into my feet. So it's very useful information, and I thank you for it.
Okay, on Zoom we have Sokyo.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your talk. I hope this isn't going sideways, but I have related to the walls in my life and so on. And I find that they're my opinions and the stories I've told myself about some things. And it's when we can face our karma and we can see it clearly enough that it lightens around us. And therefore, you know, we wash our, as if karma is a fabric, we can wash some of the stain out. It's always a propensity. But it comes up in politics, it comes up in everything, but it's such a relief not to feel the rage or the tightness in my body when those things would come up. And so I don't use the word fear very much, but I have experienced it as opinions that got in the way, that are walls. But I think rain was really important to bring up. Rain, R-A-I-N, very important technique. And doing sansen is the only other way, because you can't hide from yourself in front of another spiritual person.
Thank you. What I would add a thought that limitations, actual real limitations will tell us that they're there. The problem comes up when we tell ourselves that we have limitations. So being a little bit more receptive, a little bit more open to what is actually true and not what we imagine to be true.
Kai-in. I was wondering, when we ask the question, are we willing, am I willing to change? And the answer we get is no. What comes next?
Good question. You know, for me, the answer is almost always yes when I ask that question. So I have to kind of think around to or feel around to what a no would be. I think if I came up with a no, I'm not willing to change. That would prompt me to look further, to feel further what is happening right now. And I think that would be a very valuable message to you. No, I'm not willing to change. Where am I feeling it? What's behind this? What am I telling myself that I feel that? Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for your talk.
In Zoom, we have a comment. It's actually a question from Vic, who says, most of what's discussed involves grasping at control. Seeing when you are trying to control a scenario with holding on to your identities, etc., what are some ways you try to inject spaciousness into those moments?
Okay, what I heard, and correct me if I didn't hear this correctly, it's a little bit hard, that a lot of what we're talking about today is about controlling what happens. And what was the follow-up to that? What happens if we give up control?
What are some ways you try to inject spaciousness into the moments?
Okay, how do you inject spaciousness?
Yeah.
And who did that come from?
This was from Vic.
Okay. The curiosity. You have that attitude of curiosity. Which you can't fake. it's a natural outgrowth of willingness. You know, that what Suzuki Roshi was talking about. Just open yourself and give up everything. And actually, that's a pretty good answer to that question too, I think. How do you inject spaciousness? Just open yourself and give up everything. Yeah. So easy. Just give up everything. We there? I think, do we have time for one more or we're there? I think we're done. Thank you.